I'll tell you what I like about Chinese people. They're hanging in there with the chopsticks, aren't they? You know they've seen the fork. They're staying with the sticks. I'm impressed by that. I don't know how they missed it. Chinese farmer gets up, works in the field with a shovel all day. Shovel, spoon, come on. There it is. You're not plowing 40 acres with a couple of pool cues.
You are listening to Two Magicians, One Mic.
So we're in a secret government facility right now. And we're in a clubhouse next to... Oh, this is Two Magicians, One Mic. My name is Nick Paul, and that's Simon Cornell.
Hi there.
We have a clubhouse in our fancy apartment building that nobody knows how to use or find. It's just a circular building, and... there we found a billiards room and a jazz club on the bottom level.
And like a completely blacked out, like dark, indoor, underground basketball court.
Yeah, just pitch dark.
In the middle of, there's probably never been used ever, I would guess. I don't know. That's a very greater China. Again, Hong Kong has its shit together. Like very mainland China. And like Macau is this, you know, in development, you know. And
they're
like
figuring it out.
Yeah, facilities being built without anyone really having thought about how it's going to be used or who's going to use it. So there's all these just deserted, unused facilities all over the place.
Yeah, it's you feel like you're going into... It's that scene in Men in Black where they just go into that random elevator shaft and they go down and suddenly there's a whole government conspiracy work building. That's what we feel like we're in right now.
And it also had a little bit of a post-apocalyptic vibe. Like we went up to the pool deck, like the pool level, which is this, you know, really nice swimming pool and some chairs and tables and just deserted.
I feel like if anybody wants to know what Macau is if Las Vegas was still around after the apocalypse. In terms of, like, you go out after 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock, it's kind of deserted. You see, we were kind of exploring things that were just kind of starting to fall apart, you know?
Yeah.
new looking things, but falling apart.
But the weird thing is, so it's the opposite. It's they haven't been properly built yet. It's the opposite. Like, it's too new.
It hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
It's like pre...
Yet at the same time, you get these little interesting hotbeds of, like, activity. You know, like, you go to, you know, Club Cubic or, you know, I haven't been to Pasha yet, but I've heard. You know, you go there and it's, like, jumping full of people and really, really active.
It wasn't yesterday when it was just... This is a club in the casino hotel we work at. And there was just ladies kind of spread sporadically through this long hallway leading up to the club holding giant cardboard cutouts of cherries. And Kristen and I were very confused as if they were playing a live-action role-play of Mario Kart or something. But they were so excited when we made eye contact with them because they thought we were going to enter this club. Then we kept going because we wanted to go home. We were very tired.
Yeah, it's weird because it makes me think of... I mean, in a really roundabout way, this is a very long-stretch analogy, but LA is a city that you can't just walk around and explore like you can for most cities.
Yeah.
There's no, like, centered LA where it's all happening. In LA, you kind of need to know where you are going and who you're meeting and, you know, where the party is or where the event is or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and sort of Macau feels, in that regard, quite similar, that you can't just wander around and find what's happening. Because things are happening and there's definitely people hanging out, but they're sort of in certain places at certain times. It's not just, like, generally populated with stuff going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and again, who knows if this is just the current economic climate in Macau? You know,
maybe
all this place was packed, you know, like 2 years ago or something.
Yeah, we don't. You're like in this.
We don't know. We have no idea
where we are.
We're very confused.
We're getting a paycheck, and that's all I'm going to be concerned about because it's not my issue. It's a little daunting. People are still showing up to the shows.
Yeah,
I honestly don't know where these people come from.
Yeah.
Because it'll be empty in the hotel. Well, Chinese New Year was packed, crazy busy.
Yeah.
But this week it's slowed down. You go out to Starbucks, there's nobody in line. You go over to the food court, not many people there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm aware that I'm imagining this through the ears of a listener. Someone is probably imagining a far more desolate situation than is actually happening. Like, some of the places, like, you know, upstairs today was deserted, this building.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, it's not like there's no one in the food.
Well, you go to the Venetian, you know, which is a... Imagine the Venetian in Las Vegas and multiply it by 50. That's how big this place is. That's a little bit of an exaggeration, but still. And it's jam-packed.
Mm.
So people are shopping here. They are exploring. They do exist, but it's in weird little locations and pockets.
Yeah, on sort of occasionally unpredictable times. You know, quite when it's going to be happening. Like, again, you know, I went to one of the sort of nightclubs and it was great. It was like packed full of people who, you know, weren't jerks. It was actually a really nice, you know, really nice vibe in the place.
Yeah.
But you just, and then sometimes you get deserted pool decks and really strange under, you know, deep bunker underground badminton courts.
Yeah. It just darkness. And you're like, oh, I could be murdered here and no one would know. Yeah. But.
That's, at the same time, it's quite nice.
You know, at the same, yeah, but the thing is, that's not going to happen because the crime rate is so low.
Yeah,
here.
Basically non-existent.
So, in terms of things I've learned this week, actually, going towards the topic of what we're supposed to be discussing—not desolate locations of Macau—but the couple of things I've learned is I realize I'm less fearful of doing some of my. Pieces. There's little parts in the show that I always kind of overthought and over worried about, and now I just kind of go out and do them. I still have an overall nervous vibe throughout the show. I don't think that will ever go away, but in terms of being able to execute moves or tricks or moments in a more, I don't know, less fearful manner is kind of a new discovery for me.
Would that be, I'm guessing, would that be partly a product of just the intense schedule of having done it so many times, just doing
within,
it so
yeah, two
much.
Weeks, we've already yeah. done about 40 shows.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Know?
It's like you learn very quickly what works and what doesn't when you have that intensity of repetition, which is one of the things that I'm also realizing is even more of a blessing in disguise. You know, at first I was going, oh God, you know, oh, so many shows, I'm going to die. And it's definitely grueling, but wow, the rate at which you can break in and figure out what works and what doesn't in a new piece is incredible.
Yeah, it's a
like
gift.
Nothing else I've ever experienced.
Yeah. Know?
I mean, heck, the most intense run of shows I've ever done was the Magic Castle, right? Four sets a night, you know, for a week. Now I'm doing six sets a day for a long, you know, much longer than that. Yeah. And it's, wow, you know. The start, I'm already breaking in like three or four new routines. That normally takes months. Normally takes months to break in a new routine.
Sure.
Because of how many times you can actually perform it, you know, out there, even if you go out of your way to do test performances. Whereas now, boom.
Yeah, because you aren't just like trying it out for people. You are actually in a performance setting of, well, this is either going to work or it's not.
Yeah.
You should talk about paper balls over the head. I don't know if you want to, but to me, that's just a funny concept of something you don't normally do, but you were just playing around with an idea, and it just doesn't seem to work half the time here because of the culture difference. Mm.
So, yeah, this is, I have always been fascinated by, again, you know, as mentioned on previous episodes, a desire for sort of, you know, interactive, immersive, collaborative performing with the audience, you know, things where you create the performance with the person and have to really respond in real time to what they do. And so the magic classic paper balls over the head, you know, popularized by Slidini and many other performers, was always appealing to me. I always liked it. I also like things that, I have an intrinsic interest in things that kind of reveal the layers of perception, the subjectivity of reality, the fact that different people are observing very different aspects of the same event and how that can feel very different. And I'd studied the routine for years, but it's a scary thing to perform. Right, because it can go very wrong. Like you're very vulnerable when performing that routine, whether someone already knows it or has seen it, or if someone shouts out what's going on, or it's a very delicate thing. The timing, the angles, the misdirection, it's a very complex routine to perform well if you actually give a damn about doing it well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, partly out of sort of boredom and desperation for something to do that's different every show, you know, because even my best routines, I'm now sick of them. I've just done them so many times.
Yeah, and they don't change very much.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because they're very performing, you know, I'm going to change this bill to another bill. Yay. That's the same thing every time. And so I went, all right, it's time to do paper balls over the head.
For people that aren't magicians, it's essentially that you're throwing paper balls over a spectator's head, but in a way that they don't know. And the audience is in on the joke, but they don't know, so it's amazing to them every single time.
The primary participant perceives paper balls to be vanishing magically, and the audience sees the, you know, to them, hilariously obvious method.
But the audience, it's a great piece because the audience... The great part about it is that the audience knows not to call it out. They're in on the gag, and they know, oh, this is something special for for that person on the stage.
They get that you know that they know that you know. fast forward to China, Greater China, specifically Macau.
I think this just explains the culture difference.
Trying to get people not to immediately shout out, it's behind you, we threw it over your head. It's behind you, we threw it over your
head.
And
I assume this is not just children. I assume this is grown adults. Sometimes.
It is more children than adults, but it's adults as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just this culture of, like, bust the magician, bust them. Even if you explain, and, like, I'm explaining very clearly, you know, in Mandarin, you know, you will be able to see how I do this. This is for him. Do not tell him. You know, that's the other thing, actually, if you notice. This is one of those sort of English second language things. The verb in Chinese, Mandarin and Cantonese, to do a magic trick is to play a trick.
Huh.
To play the magic trick. In the same, which, you know, has that implication of, like, playing tricks on people. You know, it's very kind of low grade, it's very coarse, it's seen as, you know, not particularly elegant or subtle humor. It's like, ha ha ha, playing a trick.
Yeah.
And then the same thing, you know, when throwing the ball over someone's head, ha, that's a dumb trick, you know, with obviously no understanding of how difficult and complex and, you know, the beauty of the moment, the fact that to this person it looks like something impossible happened yet achieved through a mundane method, that's fascinating. But, here it's so much, in any given performance, people are way more prone to calling out and ruining it, you know, for the person on stage, who will eventually have the method revealed to them, you know, in the performance. That's the whole point of the thing. They will eventually find out. And trying to find ways to kind of combat that. And the biggest thing for me is I've just had to have sort of a branching set of possibilities so that if it gets called out and blown on the very first part of the routine, I then act like, yep, that was just a once-off throwaway dumb gag and move on, you know, not without them knowing that they just missed out on a really interesting 3 to 4 minute routine of really cool escalating phases. Yeah. But not much you can do, like, up against that culture barrier.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's some of the joys. And yeah, I there's a part where I do a phone switch and I'll do the vanish. It's so funny. This never happens in the States, but I'll vanish the dummy phone and, you know, pretend to walk off. And then I go to the person. It seems to always be a male, which is interesting to me. But they'll always point towards my case. Like, they expect it still to be in the case. And I'm like, wow, that's never happened before in the States. And then... you know, later on the reveal is it's not in the case, but that was, that got me in my head the first couple times. Like, oh, am I doing this wrong? Am I doing it weird? I'm like, no, I think it's just them wanting to immediately figure it out.
To, like, put a hazard guess out there. There's another thing that I noticed, this goes back the first few times I ever visited China. People culturally tend not to like acknowledging ignorance of something. For example, something that would happen all the time is I would ask someone directions and I could see, every now and then I could see that they didn't really know, but they would, like, point somewhere anyway that would often turn out to be wrong because they were just guessing. And I don't know how universal that is, but it's something I definitely noticed more in China than anywhere else. And I mean, the language barrier might be part of it as well. But there's this sort of thing that you, shouldn't be able to be ignorant of something because then you lose face. You know, it's like you shouldn't be... If you don't know something or you are baffled by something, nay, even quote-unquote fooled, you know, that terrible adjective to imply that if you are amazed, you are a fool.
Yeah, you're an idiot.
It's a bad word for the reaction to magic. So I think people have this idea that if they don't know how it's done, they are somehow lesser in front of everyone else. So they need to at least act like they know what's going on.
Yeah.
Which, you know, the whole thing of, you know, face and losing face and maintaining face is just one of the most profoundly, like, emotionally and culturally unhealthy concepts because it gets in the way of, you know, finding out what's actually going on. You know, if you're doing something wrong, you need to know that. That's the only way it gets better, is acknowledging fault and then repairing that. Whereas this culture of keeping face, like, acts against that happening. You know?
Yeah. How dare you say I don't know?
Yeah, exactly. How dare you say that what I did was not completely excellent in every way? And
You see that? That's an American culture thing too. I think it's progressing, but you see, there's just such a shame put on asking questions and the perception of, oh, you're going to feel or look stupid if you don't know the answer to X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, I guess it's a universal human thing.
But more so here, because I think
it's more intense.
Yeah, if you're seeing a show in America, you're able to let that go and go, oh, nobody else knows either. That's fine. Yeah. But here, it's like, I don't know, but I'm not going to show that.
I love another shout out to John in One Armstrong.
Johnny Arms has
one of the greatest China stories ever, and it's not really a story so much as an epic, like a literal epic, you know, a la the Iliad or, you know, like anything else. It's a genuine epic of a story, and in it mentions how Ed Alonso, like absolutely brilliant genius comedy magician, sure, you know, from the States, very successful, very talented, great act, was performing in China as in this show that John was in as well. And Ed's whole shtick is he's sort of got a Tommy Cooper type vibe. His tricks go wrong. Yeah. You know, everything looks like it's going wrong, and then magic things still happen, you know, quote unquote, despite his best efforts, you know, and so on. So it's very funny, very magical, in a very clever way. And China just didn't get him at all. They didn't understand, like, why don't his tricks work? What is wrong with this man? And he was on the billing, his name was put down in Chinese, translated as failed magician. That was his act title, decided by the Chinese showrunners, because they just didn't get it. Like, why would you fail on stage if you could succeed? It's like just this alien concept.
Less
of like deliberate failure-based comedy.
That's brilliant.
Like Ed Alonso, failed magician.
Sorry, Ed. Not just in China. One of the magicians we're working with by the name of Rocco, great magician in New Jersey, just doing some amazing... He's one of those guys you watch in terms of sleight of hand. Mm. It's like, I know what he's doing. I know when he's going to do it, and I still missed it. Yeah. That's how good he is. But he keeps saying that he's kind of very spiritual dude, and gives me some good life quotes here and there. And the one he keeps telling me is, the music happens between the notes, which is that old adage. And I'm like, oh, yeah. It's not about the trick. It's what you're doing in between the trick, as he was saying.
Yeah.
And it's very very true.
It's only true that the narrative happens between the panels of the comic book as well.
Yeah.
In that gap. The gap is where the mind of the reader or observer fills in the the actual content between the markers given in the panels.
Yeah, and applying that to building a trick or building a piece, building a moment, just change the game quite a bit, I think.
Well, it's funny for me, I'm noticing, it's like that old thing that, you know, if you give someone a pirate hat, they start acting like a pirate.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't remember whose theory that is. It's a very old idea in psychology. And it's really true. You know, you see it all the time. You know, if you are put in a certain context, you act differently. I find for some reason when I speak Mandarin, which I'm now basically doing my sets almost entirely in Mandarin, because these extra sets I'm doing, a lot of them are audiences that no one speaks any English. I've had like quite a few, because the extra shows are being booked apparently mostly through mainland Chinese travel agencies. So it's just less English speakers are going to be coming from those shows. And I'm pleasantly surprised to find I can basically do the whole show in Mandarin. It's not like, it's not great Mandarin. It's fairly bad Mandarin in places. There's lots of bits where I'm just like, blah, 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 blah. But it, you know, it carries. And it's like, holy crap, a white guy speaking Mandarin.
Yeah.
And I find that when I speak Mandarin, I don't know why, I turn into this kind of much more goofball, ridiculous character. Like, the energy level's a lot higher. I think maybe it's just my reaction to the culture.
Yeah,
you know, because you learn the culture as you learn the language. And the language is grammatically simpler. You know, the culture is kind of conceptually simpler in terms of performing arts and comedy and everything. So I think, yeah, I just naturally morph into this more kind of ridiculous, goofy character, which is actually kind of fun. I'm actually kind of enjoying the difference from my normally, you know,
it is
like
funny to watch you because the
excessively
Simon,
erudite character.
The Simon Cornell that I know is not that guy. And it's, I think, for anybody who is going to come visit and knows
like,
you as a performer, you're very... you know, intellectual, thought-provoking magician.
Sometimes excessively so. I will fully, freely admit that.
But that says a lot about you as a performer in terms of how you can adapt and go, okay, well, this is what needs to work here. It needs to play in a more general sense and needs to play towards this culture.
Yeah.
Because we love Ed Alonso, but you're contracted here for 13 weeks and you can't be the failed magician if you want to keep working in this country. So that makes sense.
Yeah.
Let's see here. We were talking. I'm so mad at myself. I didn't realize it till yesterday or 2 days ago when Franz was leaving. Franz Harari, the guy who created the place. I'm like, oh, we could have sat down and had a chat with him and just completely forgot.
Yeah.
I mean, he was running around doing stuff while he was here. Mm-hmm. He's working back and forth, and he's like going on a tour between China and Germany, all these places. Well,
heck, let's try and get Rocco on.
We should get Rocco on. Rocco leaves in a couple weeks, so we should get Rocco. Rocco would be fascinating to talk to.
Get everybody.
Rocco is something
three
a lot of...
Three magicians, one mic.
Yeah, that'll trip it up. Although, we're going to have to walk him through because he doesn't know how to use his Dropbox. So I don't think he's going to know how to use his telephone.
Just talk into the microphone.
but Franz was saying... you feel so much more proud of your work when you've created all your stuff. And then you look at Franz's show, no one else is... I mean, they're doing illusions, I guess, similar, but everything on stage is stuff he's designed.
But that's the same thing of, like, you know, yes, you know, a chef, like, you're still cooking the same meats and vegetables with the same cooking techniques, but you've created this different culinary experience in your kitchen.
He's designed all these pieces, designed the show, he's designed... every prop and every box and every, you know, object in it. And that's something I think, that's something I'm going to try to, it's been a learning lesson for me in terms of just trying to, I don't know, I lost my train of thought here.
make your show as personally unique as possible.
Yeah, so that way you can be up against, not up against, but working with other acts, magicians, whatever, and it's still you doing your show. If that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's good. It's good, you know, not just in terms of contrast between other acts, but also just you feel, I can totally relate to that, you feel that much deeper connection to your performance and your material and hence the audience when you know everything inside out because you built it yourself, you know, you constructed it yourself. You know, I like to build as many of my own props as I can because I know, I feel the difference. I feel like, you know, I know this thing inside out because I made it, you know.
It kills me that I'm doing multiplying bottles, I'm doing silked egg in my current set, two bits everybody does, and I'm proud that I was able to make the routines unique, I think, but it still kills me a little bit to know that I didn't build those props.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not like you have to feel the need to build everything, you know, because I can relate, I like to be able to build my own stuff. If nothing else, that means I have full control over it and I know if I'd lose it or need to, or I have an idea for a modification, I can implement that myself. But, you know, there are certain things I use that are store-bought because they're just, you know, the machining or construction required is just way beyond, you know, my abilities.
From last year's Fringe, I got, one of the reviews I got was, we love the show, it was great, blah, blah, blah. But it's amazing, he purchased most of his show from the magic shop down the street. I purchased three things from the magic shop down the street, but that hurt the most in terms of, oh, cripes, I need to work harder on that.
I mean, yes and no. I mean, you know, sure, you know, let's always try and be as good as we can at everything we can do. But at the same time, the kind of person who would recognize that, that's a fraction of a percent of the audience.
True. That's somebody who's seen a lot of magic shows.
Yeah, a magician or has seen a lot of magic shows. And that's like, that's statistically zero people, right? If you round to the nearest whole number, that's 0% of people have seen a lot of magic shows. Like, no people, you know.
That's why I didn't put in silk to egg for the longest time. I'm like, oh, everybody's seen this trick. Because I grew up seeing every magician do that trick.
No,
and
they have not
I'm
seen
amazed
it.
Still. It, 90% of the time, still gets a reaction when you crack that egg.
Most people haven't seen it. Like, you've seen it because you've been watching a lot of magicians. You're that, you know, less than 0.5% of people who watch a lot of magicians. It's not a thing. It's weird, though, now. I think that's probably increasing. It's probably more than that now, particularly because of things like the popularity of Fool Us and, you know, people who watch a lot of those clips online. And it's so weird to imagine someone watching a lot of magic without being a magician or magic enthusiast, like, without learning it. Like, people who are fans of magic with no interest in learning how to do it themselves. That's a very hard thing for me to imagine.
Yeah.
Not because I think there's anything wrong with that. It's just so different to...
Yeah, I don't... You know. I'm a mediocre drummer and I'm a fan of drums, but I can only watch so many drum videos on YouTube before I go nuts, you know?
Well, I'm imagining that, you know, magic gets a bad rap for being... you know, very homogenous. But I would imagine there'd be way more variation between magic acts than drumming acts. I don't know. I know nothing about drumming. Yeah. I'm not sure. That might be a completely wrong statement.
I would venture to say that it's the opposite. There's more variation in drumming than there is magic. Differences.
Could you do like a fuller style like talent lineup show of drumming acts?
I'm sure you could.
Really?
Yeah. The problem is everybody would be good.
Well, but as in where they would feel different to a drumming layman.
Maybe. I think because you have jazz drumming, you have rock drumming, you have so many different forms of, you have African drumming, you have all these different styles of hip hop drumming.
Interesting. Yeah, how people present their drumming, their personalities.
Yeah.
Because you get that whole thing, right? Every art form, art, craft, field of human endeavor through layman versus expert eyes. You know, like I would watch, you know, if you and I watched a show of just drummers, you would see way more differences between them than I would because you know more about it, right? So you're sensitive to the differences.
Sure.
Same with, you know, magicians can watch 10 different people doing rope acts in a row and go, oh yeah, those are all very different rope routines.
But the audience.
An average person goes, they're all freaking rope tricks, they're all the same. And that's the thing, you perceive greater granularity as an expert, which is, you know, neither right nor wrong. That just is. The expert eye sees more subtlety in the difference between things. Mm-hmm. And it's something that is just really salient. I see that with circus a lot. You know, we have a lot of overlap with the circus world.
Sure, yeah.
And watching circus pros go, you know, wow, that act was brilliant, and it completely fell flat to the audience because the audience didn't know enough about circus to understand what was impressive about that act.
Yeah.
And that's the trap that magicians, comedians, circus performers, probably even drummers fall into. You have to serve the lay audience first. Mm. They are the most important people. You've got to be going, how does this play to them? Just because you and your peers know it's really clever and innovative and original, quote-unquote, original, you know, Silk to Egg, right? Most people, 99% of people, have never seen that in their life before. So I go, wow, that's amazing.
Shout out to Scott Neary's Booby Trap. It's a variety show in LA every Wednesday. Different performers every week. Good guy, funny people. But yeah, you see that amazing circus performers who are professionals doing these amazing routines. And sometimes the audience doesn't know how to react because it doesn't connect with them. It's like, oh, look at that person doing all those crazy tricks.
Yeah, there's no context to what they're watching and why. They don't know what aerial silk is versus aerial hoop. They don't know that's a genre. Mm-hmm.
And other times it kills, you know? So it's just, it's that difference of the performer knowing how to
remember really who you're connecting with. And you are mostly, if you want to be definitely commercially successful, which I think most of us do. You know, we also want to be creatively and artistically and spiritually successful and all those things. But we also want to be commercially successful. Number one, how is this going to be perceived by someone who knows nothing about this art form, has possibly never seen anyone do anything like this before in their lives? Even in LA, right? One of the most magic saturated cities on the planet, I think, except maybe Madrid, possibly London. Yeah, like more magicians. I mean, the Magic Castle is more magicians and magic acts and ability to see magic.
Comparing Madrid or London, I assumed LA, but I didn't think of that.
Yeah, I mean, Madrid and London, I know, having lived in London and just knowing a lot of the magic scene in Madrid. Mm. But, you know, like definitely up there, like top few, if not the top one. You still get people who have, at the Magic Castle, who are going, wow, I've never seen a magic act in my life before.
Sure, that's a lot of the
A lot of people, lots of them, all the time. People have never, ever seen a magician, full stop, you know. It's important to remember, like, and again, it's that bell curve thing, right? You've got to be performing. Your crowd is probably made up of, you know, 10% people have never seen magic ever, 30% of people have seen less than 5 magicians ever, 50% of people who have seen, like, under 10 magicians ever, then a few who have seen, like, more than 10, and, like, 2% who have seen more than 20 magicians ever. You know, and it's like, you've got to make sure you're playing for all those people.
Yeah, because, you know, I remember my first time getting ready to perform there. I was like, oh, I can't do this, because all these people have seen these things. You know, they're not as original as I would like. And then you get there and you realize that, no, that's such a small percentage of people that have seen all of this stuff or have seen so many magicians.
Well, then it comes down to what is your goal, right? Is your goal to impress the most knowledgeable people? Is your goal to impress the least knowledgeable people? Is your goal to make the most money? Is your goal to be the most famous? All of these are totally different goals.
Yeah.
And some of them can overlap. You know, if you want to be famous and make money, those two go pretty well together. You know, one definitely can help out the other in either direction, in fact. But not necessarily. You know, there's a lot of very famous people who are still working at Starbucks to pay their rent. You know, I read a fascinating article on just how many, like, YouTube superstars with like millions of subscribers are barely scraping by financially. They have lots of fame, but no revenue.
I think that also comes from an oversaturated market because Bo Burnham was on You Made It Weird podcast, and he was saying, if I started now, I would be nowhere. Yeah. I wouldn't know what to do, but I just started at the right moment, at the beginning of YouTube. Mm. And he was also, I think, very talented and funny and knew what he was doing. Yeah. So,
but just a reminder that fame does not necessarily correlate with wealth.
Very true. Yeah, yeah. And I think...
Or vice versa.
And it depends if you want to play up that illusion, that persona, because, I fundamentally have a problem pretending that I'm famous or pretending that I'm more successful than I am. And I see a lot of people do that, and I'm like, well, I know you're doing the same gigs I am, and I know you're making the same amount of money I am, so I don't... It just doesn't make sense to me. But that's a way for them to make more money. They are presenting that illusion to the public, to
thus
bookers.
Thus increase their perceived value.
And so maybe they have an advantage.
It's
over
a genuine microeconomic force of perceived value, perceived... fame, and hence perceived scarcity and desirability.
Yeah, and maybe that's something I need to learn. I would rather somebody come up with the idea in their head that, oh, we like him for this reason, this reason, this reason, and he's famous, as opposed to me saying, no, you should like me for this reason, and this reason, because I'm famous, you know? Yeah. I don't know, that's...
Well, look, I mean, we would all rather a lot of things in this world.
It's true. I'm grasping at nothing. Kill myself.
There are many things about this world I would rather were different. And that's speaking as, you know, like white male first world problems as well right now.
Very
true.
And
not to get too heavy on the
podcast. We can't get too heavy in this amazing, you know, CIA clubhouse that we're in.
This is the weirdest place. It's amazing.
There's computers in this office room. And there's a sign on the door that says, no food or drinks, and then right underneath it, it says, no watching porn.
Yeah. It was no food or drinks, no something, something, and then no using computers to watch porn.
In America, that sign would be put up because that had happened before. But in this country, you just think they're just assuming the worst.
Yeah. Or you just, like, firewall off the sites. Well, you can't, that's a whole different technological can of worms, getting into, like, firewalling and... site blocking. Yeah. It's just hilarious that it's just so up there so blatantly as well. You know, in America, it would also be euphemistic. It'd be, you know, no adult-rated material. You know, there's just no porn. Word for word, direct quote, no using computers for porn.
Well, they didn't say nudie photos, so that's clearly fine.
Isn't that, you could argue that's porn. It gets into the whole, what's that famous litigious case of the judge defining pornography as I know it when I see it in America? Like 10, 20 years ago or something.
Oh, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, it was one of those landmark cases of just ridiculousness of how do you define the laws around these things.
The state of Utah versus, you know, Steve, the 50-year-old man. you gave me a good quote because I was going through some anger issues the other day with some personal things happened, and then I had to go out and do a show. And weird stuff was happening. They were dropping stuff in during the stage. The audience was reacting weird, and I was taking it personally.
It was one of those days.
You always get into it. And I was, by the end of the show, I was proud of myself. I was able to get into a state of just power through, get through it. You know, don't blame anybody. But the first two parts is the part where my wife comes out and grabs some props and hands me things, and she quietly, under her breath, goes, "Are you okay?" in front of the audience. And you gave me a good quote. What was it? You're standing in line and you have a minute to spare.
Oh, the 1 minute meditations.
1 minute meditation.
So this is double shout out. 1 minute meditation is a concept by James Altucher. I think that's how you pronounce his surname, which was first shared with me via Renee Pilkington, brilliant performer, aerialist, and many other things in Perth, Western Australia. Pointed me to this amazing article that really stuck with me. James Altucher, he's just a bizarre guy, kind of venture capitalist, like businessman, writer, philosopher, insane person, but also kind of brilliant, like fascinating person. Check out his stuff. And he had this concept of 1 minute meditations, like ways of meditating you can do, you know, in a minute, you know, in line for the bank, while waiting for a bus, you know, just here and there in between our busy lives. And he had many of these. And one of them was like spend a minute really imagining in detail, really getting to the picture that you are like in the Shawshank Redemption. You've been imprisoned, wrongfully imprisoned for life. And you've been there for years, and you know you're going to die there. The system's corrupt. There's no way out. And really imagine, what are you eating each day? What's it like waking up in the same cell, knowing this is the only place you're ever going to... Like, really get into that horrifying, depressing reality. And now open your eyes, and imagine you've just been paroled unexpectedly. And now you're free and back in line at the bank. And now you have the whole of your life ahead of you, suddenly free of this, you know, horrifying situation. And really imagine what that feels like. And there was another one that was imagine that, you know, saying that you had a terminal disease, you know, months to live, no cure. You've been writing your will, you've been saying goodbye to everyone. Suddenly it goes into remission and you're totally okay. And really spending that 1 minute, just 60 seconds, really imagining the reality of that terminal disease or that life imprisonment. And then open your eyes and, you know, whether literally or figuratively, and imagine what does life look like now through that lens. Mm-hmm. And it looks amazing is how it looks. And you appreciate everything so much more. Because it resets your baseline of expectation.
The negative cynic in me is going, well, what if you actually do get a life-threatening disease with no cure? But maybe that in itself can be a gift.
Well, even that one could be like, then, you know, like go further down. Imagine that you like had been given 3 hours to live, and now you've got 6 weeks.
Sure.
That's 6 weeks is way better than 3 hours.
You know what? I will say working on cruise ships has given me that output, because you sit on a boat for a week or a couple weeks by yourself, and the second you get off and get to see all your friends and loved ones, it's like this beautiful moment of, oh, I'm not trapped anymore. Life is wonderful.
Yeah. Another one he had that I thought was fascinating was, same thing, imagine, but imagining this time that you are a being, an alien, composed only of energy. You're an energy-based life form with no physical body from another galaxy or another universe. And you've suddenly teleported into the body of this human. Like you don't even know what humans are. You have no context for this. Hmm. You come from a pure energy nebula where everything's made of electricity and you mate by exchanging electrons and whatever. And now suddenly you've been teleported into the brain and body of this like human body, and you kind of look at your, and like open your eyes, look at your hands, everything, like the experience of touch and smell and sight and sound are new to you. You've never experienced these things before. And look around you, like, what are eyes? How do eyes work? What are fingers? How do fingers work? Like, imagine you've never experienced physical existence before. And just kind of explore your immediate environment as that energy-based alien inside this weird, you know, what you now discover as a human body. And even that, so just all these different ways of looking at reality through these little minute-long meditative practices. And he had a whole bunch more. I've got to dig out the link. I remember it being really hard to Google recently. I'll track it down.
Yeah, send it out. We can share that out.
Yeah.
So the moral of the story is, if you're having a tough show, pretend you're an alien.
You know, like, it makes it a fascinating experience.
It really does.
Because that's the point. Now you're going, whoa, sights and colors and smells. Like, what? This is amazing. What is all this? And it does really help kind of reset the context of what you're experiencing.
Yeah, because ultimately, I think we started talking about this too. Ultimately, you're getting frustrated from getting to do the thing that you worked so hard to do, which is so ironic in itself. I'm angry because I'm working and making money being a magician. Yeah. You know?
But I think you, the anger, and this is when you said about a quote, I thought you were going to talk about this one, was my friend Andrew Masters again, like his second shout out on this series, was a quote that I think he got from Dr. Phil, of all places, which is the fact that anger is always an emotional response to an unmet need or want.
Yeah.
Like if you want or need something, you can't get it. That's when anger happens.
Yeah, so, I mean, expectations.
Yeah, and so when you notice yourself feeling anger, one of the things that can help is to try and go, wait a minute, what unmet need or want is this tracing back to? And is that a fair or reasonable need or want? And often it's not when you actually examine it. And with us, with that on stage, it's... what you want, you've worked so hard on this thing for all these years, but it's not happening the way you wish you wanted it to. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like happening, you're doing a twisted parody of what you wanted to do.
Yeah.
It's like in your head it was going to be this, and it was going to be great, and you were going to connect, and it was going to, and it's not quite happening the way you meant it to. It's still happening, and, you know, was the dream really to make money earning magic, or was the dream for this routine to play brilliantly? And it's often the latter. You know, the former is great. Oh my God, that's an amazing gift.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Well, actually, and I've had anger from both sides. Like, either commercial frustrations or creative frustrations or both. You know, and right now, it's interesting. You're often getting one or the other, you know, creatively satisfying but commercially frustrating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard to, that balance is very tough. But yeah, you're right. You should, you're getting angry because you're expecting the audience to react a certain way. And when they don't, you get mad at them. Yeah. But in reality, it's like, well, they can react however they want.
Getting mad at them or yourself, you know, and either way, it's like, you know, we're only human. We can't get everything right every time. You know, give yourself some slack, you know, try and get it. That's what's good about this gig. You try and get it again on the next show, which is in 20 minutes and 20 minutes after that and 20 minutes after that. There's always another shot to try and
nail it. That's such a gift because it makes it so much easier to shake stuff off.
Yeah.
Because it's like, oh, I have to do it again. If I spend time dwelling on this, it's useless because it's a whole different audience, a whole different experience.
Well, that's something that this makes me think about with the sheer number of shows. It's no big secret that, coming from a fairly nerdy background, I have spent a lot of my life fascinated by both physical and digital trading card games, Magic the Gathering, Hearthstone, things like that. And I find them fascinating as like a game theory buff, you know, like as an amateur linguist and an amateur game theorist, I just find these concepts fascinating. And those kinds of games, to me, are the most fascinating manifestation of, it's like the best things about chess and the best things about poker all combined into one game with a bunch of other things that neither of those things have. Like, tactically, strategically fascinating exercises in human insight and ingenuity. And there's a guy, Brian Kibler, who plays both, and he talks about the concept of getting salty, getting frustrated and annoyed when things don't go your way, when you get a bad draw or whatever. And he's often asked why he's famous for never getting salty. You know, even when a game spectacularly goes against him, even though he was winning, he just usually is good at laughing it off. And his main response is always, when you've done this as long as I have and played as many hands and games and rounds and matches and tournaments as I have, you've seen everything. You've had the most insane good luck and the most insane bad luck and everything in between 1,000 times. If you have one more unlucky game, you'll have 100 more lucky ones after that. It's the amount of experience that makes it easier to weather the annoyance at the occasional bad draw.
Yeah, and it makes it easier to not cling to those moments, good or bad.
Hence, doing a lot of shows.
That's a deep way to end.
Right.
Deep way to end.
It's where I live, man. It's where I live.
Your life is exhausting.
Oh, God, it really is sometimes.
This has been Two Magicians with Mike. If you want to follow us, Simon is at Things by Simon on the Twitter and the Facebook.
On everything.
And the social
Twitter,
media.
Facebook, Instagram,
all
Snapchat,
the ways to waste
YouTube.
Time. Yep. YouTube.
Things by Simon.
I am at Nick Paul Magic, all the same devices. If you have any comments or questions, fan mail or hate mail, twomagicians1mike@gmail.com. I think that's about it for this week. Have a great couple of days.
I have a new thing that I always put out there. I will answer any question put to me on Twitter.
Ooh, that's...
There you go.
That's personal.
Ask me a thing. I mean, sometimes the answer will be, that's too personal, or see that I decline to answer, but I will at least respond to any question asked me
on
Twitter.
I want you to get a couple questions, so send Simon a couple questions on the Tweety Birds.
On the twits.
On the twits.
it's been real, everybody.
Okay, bye-bye.